7-part series in the Philadelphia Inquirer, based on a year's worth of interviews and research, uncovered a climate of violence in a number of the city's public schools. Assault on Learning found that there were 4,500 incidents of violence reported last year and more that went unreported. It also focused on the challenges the district faces trying to make a safe environment where children can learn and teachers can teach. To be honest, it was disturbing to read about violent attacks on students and teachers, but it was also heartening to know that there are programs that can make a difference, and that's our topic for today's Radio Times. And we have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studios. Kristen Graham covers the Philadelphia School District, part of the team that wrote this Assault on Learning. And Kristen Graham, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. John Bailey is Director of Continuing Education for the International Institute for Restorative Practices Graduate School. And that's based in Bethlehem. And John Bailey, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're very welcome. And rounding things out, we have Barry McCurdy. He's director of the Devereaux Foundation Center for Effective Schools, which provides training in the implementation of positive behavior supports to educators. And Barry McCurdy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Nice to be here.
Nice to have all three of you here. And Kristen, if I could begin with you. And I'm assuming some people have read this series, some people have read bits of the series, some people have not read the series at all. From your perspective, how dangerous are Philadelphia public schools?
Well, I think that violence in some schools is quite pervasive, and you know, certainly we found that there are schools that are safe and that are doing things so kids can learn every day. But it's much more serious than I think most people knew. You know, we hear about violence on the schoolyard, violence to and from school, but we reported several cases where students and teachers were attacked in classrooms. So, you know, learning is often disrupted by violence in the Philadelphia School District.
I read somewhere that you said there were times in this series when I guess you were writing and doing research on this series that you wept.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you hear about these kids who are struggling to get an education and teachers who are doing their best for kids every day and who are plagued by violence. And it's really difficult to discover that.
And in understanding schools where there is violence, are there certain themes and characteristics that you found?
Well, you know, certainly violence doesn't begin in schools. Violence begins in neighborhoods. And we found that in a lot of schools, it's things spilling over from the neighborhoods. There are, you know, street rivalries, neighborhood rivalries, and especially at the high school level when kids may come from different neighborhoods, that's certainly a pervasive problem.
How about inside the schools?
Inside the schools, that does absolutely carry over into the schools. And kids also have, you know, a lot of anger issues in some schools, and, you know, there's not a way for them to deal with it.
And I'll get to our other two guests, but also from your research, then, for the schools that seem to be able to manage some of this problem behavior, what's unique about them?
Well, we found that these schools are schools that deal with kids' social and emotional issues, and I think our other two guests will speak to that a lot. But it's important, you know, we know that there's a lot of pressure on schools for testing, that academics are crucial, but it's important to pay attention to the other side as well. It can't just be, you know, reading and math. You have to teach kids things that, you know, they're not necessarily learning at home.
Well, let me get you in the conversation, both you, John Bailey, and you, Barry McCurdy. Let me begin with you, Barry, if I could. Help us understand what, I guess, this positive behavior support system, what that's about and how that works.
Well, positive behavior support has been around for a long time, actually. And what we think about, when we think about positive behavior support, we certainly think about applying it at the individual level. It really comes from, I'm going to use a big term now, applied behavior analysis, which is really a way to change people's behavior. And and we used to, for many years, we applied the principles of applied behavior analysis to change individuals' behavior at the individual level. Then when we started to think about this, okay, these principles work, you know, it's very effective. What would happen if we would apply it at a systems level? Okay, and applying at a systems level, we get so to speak a bigger bang for our buck. Okay, we can change more behavior at that level, and so probably at about the early 1990s, we started applying positive behavior support, principles of positive behavior support at systems level. And so now we apply it to whole schools. We apply it to alternative ed programs. I'm involved in some work applying it in residential programs. And we apply it to juvenile justice programs as well.
Well, how does it work? I mean, we're talking about a school, an environment, a culture in many ways. You've got administrators, principals, teachers, kids.
And
janitors.
That's really what it is, Marty. It's about changing the culture of the school. And when we think about school-wide positive behavior support, we think about a three-tiered model. So we first of all bring in strategies into the school that will impact all students in the school, positively impact all students in the school. Those strategies include teaching expectations for behavior, acknowledging students, teaching educators to acknowledge students who are engaging in those behaviors, using data for database decision making, developing a data set so we can make sure that the important academic and social behavioral outcomes that we're trying to achieve are being achieved. Once that's in place, who now is left over? Who's still at risk? Where are some of the problem behaviors still? And so we bring in different strategies for that group of kids. And then at the third tier, a group of strategies for kids in greatest need.
And one more question, then I'll get to you, John.
Sure.
Bailey. But so you're talking about creating what rules, regulations, expectations, consistency, that this is,
right,
in this school, this is how we behave. This is how we deal with problems. This is how we learn.
That's
this
exactly
is how we
right. yeah.
reward good behavior.
Right.
And everyone sort of buys into
this. We get everybody on board. And the principal has to be, the principal is a critical element here. The principal has to be on board with us. We know that that makes a difference.
And it's positive. I mean, the idea is you reward good behavior.
Very much so, because, again, we know that just taking that punitive, reactive approach really doesn't change behavior in the long term. It'll change behavior in the very short term, but it doesn't change behavior in the long term. And that's what we want, is long-term change.
And I want to pick up on that. Let me get you in on the conversation, John Bailey. You're talking about a program of restorative practices, and I know you had used this in West Philadelphia High School. How does that work?
So similar concepts in terms of where does the root of building good community and behavior come from. So what we focus on is the development of community, proactively developing social capital, and then by extension, how you respond to wrongdoing will be reflected in that. So when we work with a school, what we do is we provide a range of simple skills trainings for all staff. And by all staff, we mean everyone who has contact with children, from teachers, administrators, janitors, hallway monitors, lunchroom workers, because they're not all ladies.
No, they're not.
Bus drivers, when appropriate, even school-based police officers. And that's a critical piece for anyone interested in school reform. A lot of programs operate as we're going to train a few people to be super facilitators or to run interventions. Interventions after the fact, after there are problems, will never accomplish culture change. You need to have a range of practices, most of which are informal. So we teach people, how do you build relationships? How do you talk to people in a way that says, I find you important as a human being, that actually builds relationships and builds the social bonds that make it less likely that people will misbehave in the first place. And then by extension, when they do misbehave, because children will, and you're not allowed to act shocked when they do, when they do misbehave, how do you hold them accountable in a way that pays attention to relationships and repairs harm that's done to the real people, as opposed to just punishing people from the rule book?
Well, let's say two kids get in a fight, which happens, and that happens in schools all across this country, using this restorative practices model. How do you deal with that?
So that's a really common situation. And one of the changes is, I mean, and I worked in a school myself. I come from alternative ed, so we're used to seeing, problems and problems like this. And we work in a lot of really tough urban schools. So there's a fight in the building. Something really serious has happened. People are hurt. A lot of times the mandate is they're going to be suspended in some kind, and there might even be criminal charges, depending on how severe it was. All right, so you have two children that are going to be removed from the school environment for some period of time. Let's say it's mandated. Okay, well, are they going to come back?
Uh-huh.
Are they ever going to come back? Uh-huh. If they do come back, they're going to be walking right back into the same relationships, the same inter-student conflicts, the same groups of friends, staff, who, whether they say it or not, might be gunning for them in some way, or just feeling unsafe and unsure. What do you do to deal with that emotional piece? So we teach schools how to implement things like restorative conferences, where student gets suspended. Okay, let's say they're coming back. You have an opportunity. It's a structured, formal process where people have to sit down with the person who did it, the people involved, the people who were impacted. And I think this is real accountability, where the students have to be confronted with the real people they've harmed and impacted, including the people who they've just maybe terrified vicariously by what they've done. And that students,
and say, I'm sorry?
Well, maybe. I mean, but it's not mandated apology, and it's not sort of let's just hug each other and pretend that this is over. It's about making people, ensuring that people are confronted with the real human impact of their behavior. And that, in terms of toughness, students will tell you that's a lot tougher than being sent home for 4 days.
I mean, it sounds like it's relation. It's about all the relationships that we have in schools.
It's relational accountability, and it's some way. I mean, if your child acted in a way that was outrageous in your family, what would you do to help that child? Number one, hold that child accountable to the standards that you have, but then help them understand how that has really impacted all the people they're supposed to care the most about. And that's the approach you have to take to school culture if you're actually going to change it. And that's what coercion can accomplish by itself.
Let me go back to you, Kristen. Now, the Philadelphia School District has a program called Comprehensive Student Assistance Process, or CSAP.
CSAP.
How does that work?
So CSAP is the district's main system of interventions. And for many years, it was if a student had a problem with behavior, if there was some emotional issue, a student would be enrolled in CSAP. Under Dr. Arlene Ackerman, the program has been expanded to also handle academic issues. So if a student is failing a course, if a student is lagging behind academically, then a student is also enrolled in CSAP. We found that over the past 3 years, the number of students enrolled in CSAP has greatly increased. And
to the point where there are a third of the students
Now,
the system are enrolled.
51,166 of the district's roughly 155,000 students were enrolled in the program last school year, 2009-10. And what we found are there just aren't the services to serve those kids, and a lot of the kids don't get all the services they need. We heard anecdotally from teachers who would say, you know, I had a student who was in CSAP who really needed to be evaluated, who really needed services. They never even got seen. And so in some cases, CSAP can be enormously effective, but we found that often in the Philadelphia school system, it is not.
And it's because, is there enough staff to make sure that students who need this help are getting it?
Well, I mean, it's often the teachers, it's not like the teachers aren't flagging them. The teachers are it's going down the line, you know, are there enough staff to evaluate the kids? And CSAP is a three-tier process, so, you know, the first tier isn't necessarily kids getting evaluated. That doesn't come until later, and you have to be in the first tier for a certain number of, I believe it's a month, I'm not entirely sure. But it takes a long time for kids to get to that second level, and we're finding that kids are languishing in the CSAP system often.
We're almost up on a break here, but Barry, you said right before we went on the air, if a third of the students are enrolled in this program, that tells you something is wrong.
Well, we shouldn't be dealing with that many students in that great a need, and this is not specific to Philadelphia. This goes across all schools. First of all, the CSAP program, I think, is well-structured. It's a well-structured program. It's great that Philadelphia has it. It is a three-tiered model, much like school-wide positive behavior support. Mm. The problem is, I think, the problem comes in to the in the sense that schools don't always know what the practices are that should be going on at that second tier and at that third tier, and then implementing those practices once they know what they are can be more challenging as well. So.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about how to make Philadelphia public schools, or perhaps even beyond Philadelphia, how to make schools safer for students and for teachers. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
1812 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. Now playing Neil Simon's classic comedy, Laughter on the 23rd Floor. It's the 1950s in America, and the fight to be funny is on. Laughter on the 23rd Floor takes us backstage at Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows for a fabled account of how writers Mel Brooks, Woody Allen, Carl Reiner, Larry Gelbart, and others made comedy history. Tickets and information at 1812productions.org.
This Week in This American Life, what do you do when somebody's stealing from a gift shop? Call the authorities, set up a sting.
And he's looking through the binoculars, and he would tell me, somebody's coming to the gift shop, take a look at this, tell me who this is. Who is this? Is this our guy? Is this our guy? And I would look, and I'd say, no, that's not our guy. That's an 85-year-old woman selling spoons to a customer.
Unsuspicious minds stalking criminal minds this week.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Widener University School of Law supports WHYY. Widener Law's MJ in Health Law focuses on risk management, contract negotiation, legal nurse consulting, as well as regulatory and hospital compliance. Taught by a nationally recognized faculty, this part-time evening master's degree program is designed for healthcare and other professionals seeking graduate-level training. A Thursday, April 7th open house at the Delaware campus will provide details about the MJ in Health Law. Register at law.widener.edu.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We are talking about how to make Philadelphia public schools safer, and the Philadelphia Inquirer ran a 7-part investigative series on violence in the city's public schools, and that series called Assault on Learning. And one of the reporters for that series is Kristen Graham, and she covers the Philadelphia School District for the Philadelphia Inquirer. John Bailey is also with us, Director of Continuing Education for the International Institute for Restorative Practice Graduate School, that's in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and Barry McCurdy also with us, and he's the director of the Devereaux Foundation Center for Effective Schools, and that provides training in something called positive behavior supports. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. John, if I can go back to you, one of the critiques is that in order to help bring some kind of stability to schools, you need to work with parents. The parents are key to helping their child achieve in school and behave in school as well. But I'm hearing from both you and Barry that you're really working on changing a school environment. I don't hear a lot of parent talk.
Yeah, when we work with especially our whole school climate change program in schools, we always include measures to engage parents. A lot of what the staff actually have to, and we measure this as a part of the program, work on is how they engage with parents. People talk a lot about what's wrong with parents, but I think it's important for schools to look at how do we actually engage with and interact with them if we engage with them in a way that just basically allows them to remain passive and doesn't give them an actual role to play in either managing behavior or buying into what we're doing in the school. Well, we shouldn't be shocked when they seem to have a certain amount of apathy or don't show up for meetings. So we do things, we help through restorative practices training, give parents a much larger role and say in what is happening in their child's life in the school. So one of the things we say is treating them like the experts on their own children, even when those parents might have some struggles and problems themselves. The other thing is, and I think this is really important because we come, especially in urban schools, we come up against it again and again. You can't make the lack of achievement or success the fault of parents or communities. If that is the opinion of building leadership or district leadership, you'll never be able to move forward, because the reality is you can make life different the moment they walk through the front door, and the most successful building administrators and the most successful school districts at implementing programs have said, there are lots of things that affect the geographical community, but when they walk through the front door, this is the environment that we want to build, and that's the right approach. And it's actually the most respectful approach as well.
You're nodding your head. Barry McCurdy, go ahead.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with John. I mean, it's great to have parents on board, and we encourage schools to invite parents to be on their leadership team as they're building their system of school-wide positive behavior support. But the reality is that what we know we can do is we can change child behavior. We can change student behavior in the environment. It's about changing the environment. It's about changing the environment of the school. That's correct. Yes.
And as you described the program, it really is the you know, from the janitor, so to speak, to the principal.
Right. John said the same thing, actually, getting everybody involved. Mm-hmm. Cafeteria workers, aides, janitors, principals, office workers, everybody's on board.
Kristen, let me go back to you and back to the report, because one also gets the sense that teachers are frustrated. They're overwhelmed.
That's a safe statement to make.
Yeah, they're overwhelmed. They don't feel like they have, perhaps in some situations, the support of administrators or support of the district. In certain cases, they don't have the skills to deal with some of the problems that kids are bringing to school.
Right. We interviewed hundreds of teachers for our series, and what we frequently heard is, we're educators, we're trained to teach kids reading and math, and we don't necessarily have the background to deal with the social and emotional issues. And, you know, teachers are very involved and they're terrific, but they need support. And, you know, we often hear also from teachers, well, you know, the parents aren't involved, and that's you know, we got a lot of feedback from from folks saying, well, where are the parents? But we know in urban districts, you know, they struggle with parent involvement, and you can't hold a student you can't penalize a student if their parent's not involved. The teachers and the schools have to deal with it.
It was disturbing to read a number of the incidents, and including the fact that the level of violence in some elementary schools, and we're talking in some certain cases, you know, first graders, kindergartners, who are assaulting teachers or other students.
Absolutely. We found that, I believe the number was 1 in 8 violent assaults happen with students who are 10 years old or younger, and 10 years is the cutoff. If a student is under 10, they can't be criminally charged. And just really disturbing information about this is happening in the youngest grades. It's not just the high schools. It's it's something that needs to be addressed.
Well, let me go back to you, Barry, because, and you don't want to make blanket statements about anybody, but if you have elementary school kids who are assaulting other kids, I mean, to me, that's a sign of a child in serious trouble.
Okay. So then let's fix it.
Exactly.
So, and I say that facetiously, but, you know, what we know about behavior and what we know about changing people's behavior is that it's a lot about teaching, okay? I always say to teachers when we're working with teachers, what I say to a psychologist, because we do a lot of training of psychologists, is you're not doing anything different than a good teacher wouldn't do. You're teaching skills to your patients, to your clients, so that they can change their behavior. That's exactly what we have going on in schools.
Even with the 5 or 6
we're training teachers to change behavior. We're teaching teachers how to teach to behavior to make the change.
So if, to use an example, you know, an elementary school kid tries to hit a teacher.
Right.
What does a teacher do?
Okay. Well, so we don't want to react too much to that. So the normal consequences come into play. Whatever the consequences are that the school has decided that they're going to use, those normal consequences come into play there. Okay. When the child is back in school, and if we're still seeing that behavior, what we want to do is we want to teach the behavior before it becomes serious, before the child starts hitting again. Okay. So what's the reason? What's the purpose for the hitting? What's going on here? And trying to uncover, you know, why or the reason for the behavior, and then teaching to it. Let's teach you a different way. So teaching problem-solving skills or teaching any other skills that will prevent that behavior from occurring, whatever the purpose of that behavior is.
And to intervene, I mean, the idea sounds like sort of setting the stage even before something happens to say, in this school, this is what we do when we feel angry. For instance.
Yes, that can be part of it, sure. And typically what happens with school-wide positive behavior support is we have a data system. So we're looking to see where are these behaviors occurring. Are there more fights occurring on the playground? Are fights occurring in the cafeteria? And if they are, then let's design a plan or an intervention that typically involves mm-hmm. teaching so that we can address all the kids in the cafeteria. We can address all the kids on the playground.
John, let me turn back to you. And I'm sure there are a lot of or a fair number of teachers, students, and parents, administrators who would say, if there's a problem child, I want them removed. I want them out of my classroom. I want them out of my school. I want them to go to some other place where they can get the treatment or get the help that they need. How do you deal with someone who's sort of a continuing problem in a school?
Sure. It's a great question. I mean, look, and I'd be the last person to say that people who are dangerous to themselves or physically dangerous to themselves and other people should just remain in the building with no consequences. I mean, I've had, when I worked in alternative programs, children removed from our school in handcuffs, and it was the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. I think the issue becomes you can't arrest or suspend or expel your way into having a positive learning community. I mean, ultimately, what the Philadelphia School District and every other school district in the country is accountable to is test scores and academic performance. And it's a very simplistic and appealing idea that if we just remove the 10%, 7%, 15% of students that cause the most problems, then we'll have safe schools. One of the problems with that is nature abhors a vacuum.
Really?
So you will always have a certain amount of students misbehaving. So it's a question of how we deal with them, become more elastic to reclaim some of those students. The other problem is those students don't actually go away. They go somewhere, and they go to someone else's program, or they go to someone else's institution. So if we're going to truly see our city as a community, you can't pass the buck forever. So I think the goal is, and when we work with the school, is if you think about it like a pyramid, at the bottom you want to get as much voluntary cooperation as possible, spending more time doing that. And that's one of the biggest struggles, especially in some of the more violent or chaotic schools, is most of the time is spent responding to putting out fires and the crisis of the day, and you never actually get in charge and on top of the culture itself by getting back to the positive community building, building relationships. And that's not a soft approach. Anyone who's worked with tough people will say the most effective programs are the ones where the staff knew how to build relationships with the youth. And I think even importantly around, like your question about the elementary school, right. And you know, how do you hold students accountable? You get them to hold each other accountable. And that's what real communities do. And so when we teach practices, it's not just teaching young people how to behave. It's getting them to engage with each other so they tell each other, these are our expectations of you and from ourselves, and you could begin to get them to do the discipline work in some ways for you. And that's the real magic of how communities can actually have a high amount of social discipline.
And that's John Bailey, who joins us along with Barry McCurdy and Kristen Graham. We're talking about the Philadelphia Inquirer 7-part series looking at violence in some of the public schools here in the city of Philadelphia, and talking about programs that can deal with some of the chaotic classrooms and some of the risky schools and classrooms in the city as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Before I get to our callers, Kristen, let me go back to you, because you also wrote about Washington High School having a mentoring program.
A peer mentoring program.
So yep. Picking up on what John was just saying.
Absolutely. Washington High and several schools in the district have really successful peer mentorship programs where essentially kids are holding each other responsible for the lower level stuff. I mean, if a serious incident occurs, it's not the purview of the kids to handle it. But in this case, if, you know, there's tough talk in the hallway, or I wrote about a case where a student threw a pencil at another student, and it seemed like those kids were going to fight. There are trained students, and they typically have to, you know, have good grades and, you know, be responsible. And the students are trained, and usually once a day there's a time where they mediate incidents. They sit down, they talk about what happened, they're trained to be respectful, and Washington has had this program in place for 25 years, and
wow.
They say that about 300 incidents a year are mediated, and the kids just say it's such a successful program, and it really creates a culture of respect at the school. It's not to say it ameliorates everything, but it does take care of a lot.
Well, and which is interesting, and I have to say, reading the series, you see programs being tried and then stopped and moved and
absolutely,
ended.
It's one of the key challenges.
Well, it is one of the key, which is figuring out what works and then trying to apply it, I guess, what, across the district?
Right, a district of 257 schools. How do you replicate that? And we found that there are terrific programs in pockets in place in the district. There are schools that are doing it right, and they're not necessarily the magnet schools or schools in certain geographic areas. You know, these are all kinds of schools. It's just the challenge of replicating this district-wide, which is something that hasn't happened in Philadelphia.
And would you say the principal is key?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Principal and staff are key. A lot of the schools that we've seen have leaders who have been in place for a long time, a stable faculty, and it's just, you know, building will. You can't say, you know, we're going to do this, and, you know, whether you like it or not, you really have to build that consensus at the school level.
Would you agree with that, Barry McCurdy?
Totally. It's about commitment. It's about commitment at the school level, and it's about commitment at the district level. Anymore, when we're doing training in school-wide positive behavior support, it's rare that we go into an individual school. We're asking districts, whole districts, to make commitments now, because we know that that's what's needed to sustain right. programs like this.
Well, and I'm thinking not just for the Philadelphia School District, but districts across the country. They're under the gun to have high test scores. Now there are money problems, there are concerns, certainly in the state of Pennsylvania, what's going to happen to funding for schools across the board.
Yeah. It's a sad state, unfortunately. Funding for schools is certainly going to probably translate to a cut in a lot of programs. But I want to point out one thing. There's one good example here, and I'm going to draw your attention to Milwaukee Public Schools. The Council of Great City Schools, about a year and a half ago, identified Milwaukee Public Schools as one of the urban schools with the highest suspension rates. At the same time, they were undergoing a very serious state budget cut, very serious cut in funding for the schools. Moved ahead, decided that they're going to bring in a district-wide implementation of school-wide positive behavior support. They began with 30 schools. Now they have more than 100 schools involved. After only a year of bringing this in and schools getting up to fidelity with implementing school-wide positive behavior support, they've seen a nice reduction in the number of days out of school due to suspension.
And nice, you mean like significant?
Yes, significant, right, yes.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. We have Ron from Mount Airy joining us on Radio Times. And Ron, go ahead, you're on the air.
Thank you, Marty. The reason for my call, I think, addresses two things that are that seem to be in direct conflict, at least in the Philadelphia schools, and that is what to do to turn around the panicky situation right now and what the long-term objective is. I was brought into a school that was already fairly well-known for violence. It was an elementary/middle school. Middle school students frequently were truant or, worse yet, cutting and wandering the halls, dropping in unannounced on younger classes and creating problems with students who were in the hallway. We often had hall sweeps and other things to try to curb violent and truant behavior. In my class in particular,
Can I hold on one second? I just, if you can get to your point only because I'm looking at the clock and I want to make sure one of our guests has a chance to respond. The problem was?
Yes, behavior.
What's that, Ron? And,
I'm sorry?
If you can get
what
to your...
Was it?
No. If you can just get to your point, that would be great. I appreciate your description of what you had to deal with. And the problem was?
The problem was that when I tried to call security when I was attacked in one classroom, one class period, security came, but then they told me I was not going to see them the rest of the day and that I was on my own. Literally, that's what they said. And needless to say, the second period, the small group of problem children in that classroom, of course, by this point, they're all, 5'8" or taller. So it wasn't like I could just beat them up or protect myself.
Well, Ron, let me just take your point because, again, I'm looking at the clock and I want to toss this to you, John Bailey. What I hear from his story is that he felt like he wasn't supported in his classroom. He had to deal with a potentially scary situation, and he didn't feel supported.
Right. It's interesting, and I'm sorry, Ron, for your experience.
Indeed.
I mean, that's hard. And I've worked with teachers and been in schools where people have felt like that they're in that position. I think the main issue is there's an old way of looking at education, even just in terms of instruction, that I think gets applied then to how we handle community and conflict. The old way of looking at yourself as a teacher is that teachers are in private practice. They're hired by the school, but in large part their classroom is their own domain. They handle things the way they will, which has an amount of freedom to it and some privacy and all of that. Unfortunately, in schools where that become chaotic and violent, where teachers are actually in fear for their physical safety, it can also lead to an environment where teachers feel like, unfortunately, they're on their own when they walk through the front door, even though they may have 70 other colleagues in the building. And that one of the things we do in the restorative practices approach is to get the, I mean, honestly, and this might be an odd thing for some of the listeners, changing children's behavior is the easiest part of what we do.
Hmm.
Children will change quickly when the adults in the building have a coherent vision for where they want to go and make some commitments to one another to both support each other and so what it is they're actually going to implement. So in a school like Ron was in, the most important part would be that creating a community also amongst the staff so that they support each other in getting on top of those serious problems.
And we'll pick up on that after this very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about how to make schools safer. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Speaker Series, presented by Widener University in its 8th season, featuring General Stanley McChrystal, food activist Michael Pollan, Valerie Plame Wilson, and Ambassador Joe Wilson, and Tom Brokaw. 7 evenings at the Kimmel Center designed to enlighten and inspire you. An exciting season of diverse ideas, world perspectives, and thought-provoking conversation. Information available at PhiladelphiaSpeakerSeries.org. Sponsored by WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. An Irish journalist considers the Irish Church's role in the global clergy sex abuse scandal. Also, what lessons can businesses learn from events in Japan? Have a contingency plan. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The Wistar Institute is proud to support WHYY-FM. I'm Dr. Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute, a world leader in biomedical research right here in Philadelphia. Today at Wistar, scientists can explore our entire set of genes to answer the question, what causes cancer? This research guides us to design individual therapies for different types of cancer. The Wistar Institute, today's discoveries, tomorrow's cures, online at wistar.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Kristen Graham. She covers the Philadelphia School District for the Philadelphia Inquirer, part of a team of reporters that looked at violence in the city's schools, that series called Assault on Learning. Also with us is Barry McCurdy, director of the Devereaux Foundation Center for Effective Schools, and John Bailey, director of Continuing Education for the International Institute for Restorative Practices. We're talking both about the problem and ways to think about some of the solutions. 1-888-477-9499. Barry, if I can just turn quickly to you, and based on our caller right before the break, is I get the sense, and even from reading the series, Kristen, is that teachers, especially perhaps working in urban or poor districts, need specialized training to deal with some of the problems that kids bring to school.
They really do. It's they're not getting it, I don't think, in colleges and universities, in the general education track. When we are working with teachers, with regular ed teachers, general ed teachers, we see that. We know that we need to do more training there. The teachers who are getting the training actually are teachers who are in special education.
Oh, that's interesting.
The training to deal with some of these issues. And very often, but not always, they can do a pretty good job in urban schools. The other way that teachers can perform better in urban public schools is if they have at least had student teaching experience in urban schools. But when you get a teacher that's coming right out of a general ed program, general ed training program at a college or university, no student teaching experience in urban schools, being thrust right into an urban classroom, it can be overwhelming for that teacher.
Kristen, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I talked to hundreds of teachers. My colleagues and I talked to hundreds of teachers, and that's one of the first things we heard, that, you know, we're just not equipped to deal with it. And these are terrific, bright professionals who are very committed to their students, but, you know, the students just bring these issues that they're not equipped to deal with. And it really is an issue, and one that we've known has existed for a while.
Well, and I can't imagine anything more frustrating than being a teacher in a classroom where you feel like you can't teach.
Right, absolutely. I mean, just the basic level of, you know, we think about what goes on in a classroom. If you're simply dealing with a few students who have issues and who are disrupting the class for everyone, you cannot teach.
Right. And what's been the school district response to this series?
The school district has pointed out things that they've put in place, and, you know, they've admitted that there are problems that they can't deal with, and they've looked to outside organizations for help. They've looked to the city, they've looked to city police, but they've acknowledged that it's a huge problem.
Well, and I noticed yesterday Mayor Nutter had a meeting to talk about this issue of school violence.
Right. We've been talking to legislators who say they're going to call for hearings, and the mayor has promised action on this as well.
Do you think hearings help?
I think what happens after hearings can help. Some of the recent hearings of the Human Rights Commission, I mean, there were some useful things that came out of that.
And that was the South Philadelphia High School situation.
Yeah, spurred on by that. And, it gave a voice for, I mean, what we saw, frankly, was pretty amazing. I mean, things that I didn't see 10 years ago. And you had students, parents, teachers all uniting around pretty similar messages around what they thought the solutions to some of these problems were. They talked about things like, we need to be building a positive community, we need a way to deal with behavior, and that's not just about increased policing and coercion, but also we want to be safe. You know, and if my child was going to South Philadelphia High School, I'd want to be assured that they were going to be physically safe too. The question is, where is the research about what actually accomplishes that? Programs like restorative practices, programs like positive behavior supports, there are programs that have been proven to work that have been taken to scale in big cities. Right. We're in Detroit, San Francisco, Tucson, Arizona, New York City. Yeah. So the question is, how do you get a large school district to take proven effective programs to a larger scale? And that's the most complex question, much more so than what works with kids.
Let me get Lisa from East Oak Lane to join us on Radio Times. And Lisa, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I have a question for Kristen.
Yes.
The series really was excellent but very disturbing. One of the schools that you focused on was AB Day Elementary which has a pretty low incidence of violence.
Right.
One of the things that the principal said there was, because I've been here for a long time, many of the teachers have been here for a long time, it's a very stable environment, which makes sense. But what we're seeing is that the school district, through its Renaissance Academies and Promise Academies, are transferring most of the faculty in that building, and sometimes the administration also. My question is, how can the school district say that they're doing something about violence and maintaining, or instituting programs, when the way that I see it is with all these schools being restructured, 14 last year, 18 this year.
Well, Lisa, let me take your question.
All I'm saying is,
no, we hear you.
A climate of instability.
No, we hear you. And Kristen, do you have thoughts about that?
Sure. Well, Lisa, I can't answer for the district, of course, but I would say that what I reported about at AB Day was absolutely a lot of the good programs in place at Day happened because the principal has been there for a long time, the faculty is very stable, and we know that funding sources come and go, especially in a climate now when the school district has a $629 million budget deficit they're facing for next year. But the principal said, you know, when funding was in place, I grabbed it. I got as many folks trained as possible, and then we carried it through. We take things from year to year. And so, absolutely, if you have a team of mostly new teachers, it's going to be difficult because, as we've said, folks aren't trained to deal with a lot of kids' problems. So you're just kind of, you know, coming up to speed. So to keep programs in place is really difficult, and I think is something that the district must tackle to fix this problem.
Let me get Meg from Bryn Mawr to join us. And Meg, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. I heard them talking about teacher training, and I really, I'm sorry to see the funding situation that we're in, because we've discovered it's so important. Children have, some children are motivated differently. You can have some children that will respond to a consequence and know that because that consequence is there, their behavior needs to change, and they'll do it. And then you have children that are chronically inflexible, that don't deal well with transitions or other things. And those are the kids that explode in school and that become the problems. And a lot of times, school counselors are not even well trained in how to problem solve differently with those children,
sure,
let alone teachers. And I wondered if anyone on your panel is familiar with Ross Green and his book, The Explosive Child, which is used now in a lot of schools in training counselors and teachers about how to deal with children who actually are motivated to do well but don't have the set of skills that they need in order to remain calm in a school setting.
Well, Meg, yeah, let's take your question, and because this is an issue, and actually, let me go first to you, Barry McCurdy.
Sure, yeah. Well, thanks. That's a good question. Actually, when we talk about teacher training, we said that general ed teachers teaching in general ed programs need more training. Counselors in this day and age, especially in urban schools, need more training. I know Ross Green's work. I don't know it as well as I probably could, but I know where he's coming from. I've read some of his work. And yes, he provides some really good examples and good training for how to help professionals address the needs of these children. There are always going to be children with persistent behavioral problems. No matter what systems you put in place, we're going to see children with persistent behavioral problems. And what we know we need to do is, again, develop individualized and intensive support, more intensive supports for that population. Counselors have not been trained to do that. Teachers are really not trained to do that. And I come from the field of school psychology, and many school psychologists actually are not well trained to do that, although more and more are becoming trained.
John, is there a connection between academics and behavior? I mean, the idea that if you can create a sort of a stable classroom or school, that actually results in learning?
Sure. Well, I mean, just using a Philadelphia example, with our work at West Philadelphia High School, we saw what we've seen in many of the urban schools we worked with, where in a two-year period we had decreased major assaults, infractions, purposely set fires by as much as 2/3 in the building. So dramatic culture climate change. So a part of raising test scores and academic performance is the academic climate and the instructional environment. So if you have people who on a Maslow's hierarchy of needs are worried about their sheer physical safety, you can implement the most expensive curriculum program in the world and they're not going to be performing to their capabilities. They might perform a little bit better. But instructional climate is at the heart of any kind of academic performance, and that's what we help provide. So one of the tragedies of what happened at West Philadelphia was there was a shakeup, part of which I'm told was for the test scores not climbing rapidly enough. Mm-hmm. Yet you have a climate that had begun to become under control, people talking about how safe the building now was in comparison to how it had been. And I understand there's complex reasons why decisions are made, and I'm not impugning, you know, those decisions themselves, but having a much more holistic look at, okay, I understand that academic performance is the most important thing, but that is a very that's a much more complex and holistic issue than simply how much time are we spending teaching this particular curriculum. You know, it has to do with emotional and social health. It has to do with, you could have students seated in chairs looking like they're paying attention, but in fact they're not performing up to standards because they're worried about their physical safety. And I've seen that too. I mean, you see that in detention centers,
sure,
where you might have physical order, but you don't have social or emotional health because the environment is so toxic or, you know, frightening or dangerous.
Yeah.
So.
Did you want to
just wanted to weigh in? One of the things we saw at Day, the school that one of the callers mentioned, was that after they had these social and emotional programs in place, test scores did climb, and the school was really performing very well. And so that, you know, in West Philadelphia, you know, there were only 2 years for the school to improve, and the test scores were quite low. But in Day, where the program has had a more sustained effect, you do see academics rising.
Let me get go ahead.
I want to add one other thing to that, academic outcomes are sort of a distal impact of some of these programs. Not something that we're working on directly. What we know from one of the randomized controlled trials, this sort of gold standard research that's been done on school-wide positive behavior support, is that we've seen in one of those trials an increased proportion of third graders meeting state reading standards. Mm. So we've seen it actually.
Let me get, looks like Thomas from Newark, Delaware, to join our conversation. And Thomas, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, how you doing?
Hi there, good, how are you?
I was telling her earlier that my daughter, who's 9 years old, was attacked by another student. And she was choked, scratched, and threatened with rape by what appeared to be a gang of boys.
Oh, dear.
And I live in a community that you would not think things like this happen. And what I'm wondering is, my question is this violence problem pervasive in all the school system, but covered up better because after the investigation was over and all that stuff, this child is right back in class with my daughter again.
Oh, goodness, Thomas.
So this is, you know, something that I'm just wondering about. Mm. Is this stuff really going on everywhere, covered up better, or washed over, or is this really just an urban problem?
Well, Thomas, I appreciate the call, and I'm sorry what happened to your daughter. And actually, if I could maybe toss that to you, Barry McCurdy, we're obviously talking largely about Philadelphia, based in part on this series in The Inquirer, but how pervasive is this problem?
Violence in schools, how pervasive is the problem? I don't think it's just an urban problem, although I think we see more and more of it. We see more of it in urban schools, but I don't think it's just an urban problem. I think it's a problem that goes across many schools.
And certainly I heard from readers after the series ran, you know, I'm at a suburban district and there's violence in my school as well. So, you know, certainly it's not just an urban problem.
Thomas, thanks for calling in. Let's see what Christian from North Philadelphia has to say. And Christian, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Sure, yeah. I'm calling from North Philadelphia. I work at a school called Youth Build. And we have implemented the restorative practices in our school very successfully. We actually worked with IRP to do a school-wide training for all our staff. And these are kids who come from every part of Philadelphia and have all kinds of behavioral problems. And I think the thing that works best for us is that we start from scratch and we say we respect you up front. And it starts a completely different culture than what they're used to. And I don't know how that can be implemented, you know, district-wide and how we can do that in every school. But for us, using those restorative practices has worked really well with that culture of mutual respect.
That's a great call. Go ahead, John Bailey.
Yeah,
you're
thanks,
smiling
well,
at
thanks
me.
Well, thanks for calling. yeah.
And that's a program called Youth Build.
Yeah, that's Youth Build Charters. They've done tremendous work in the city, and as well as a few others that are also implementing our program. You know, you touch on, the caller touches on one of the most important issues. The ability of children themselves to actually change the school environment and it's the least likely answer to what actually works. From a distance, if you were to look at schools and the problem of pandemic violence and culture issues from a distance, you would think, well, they're the perpetrators. Why would they, if they wanted to change this, they would already be behaving differently. Well, it's actually not the case. I mean, in West Philadelphia High School, and, you know, the caller just talked about it, what she saw at Youth Build, it's the children themselves, while having a slightly different structure and guidelines of how they're going to interact with one another, setting expectations that they're going to treat it like a community, hold each other accountable, and set expectations. That's what we saw at West Philly. Mm-hmm. There was no Superman who came to – I mean, the leadership there did great, and the staff did a wonderful job. We did a great job training them. But it was actually the children who made the difference. I went into the same classrooms where when I went in the first time, no one – I mean, it was – complete chaos to children sitting in a circle, talking about a recent incident that happened, and then getting back to instruction. It was amazing. And the children themselves said, look, I participated in the chaos in the past, but I just didn't know how else to be. This is the way this building has always been. This gave us a structure and a way to deal with each other in a way that was calmer, safer, and, you know, and more healthy.
And we're almost out of time. You want to add to that, Barry?
Sure,
McCurdy?
Yeah. I agree. I agree. It's about changing the culture. It's about impacting the culture. You're changing the climate of the school. Everybody gets on board. Kids get on board. They know what's expected, and then they hold each other accountable.
Well, on that note, I thank all three of you for joining us. Chris and Graham, I congratulate you and your fellow reporters at the Inquirer for the series about the Philadelphia School District called Assault on Learning. John Bailey is a Director of Continuing Education for the International Institute for Restorative Practices, and Barry McCurdy is Director of the Devereux Foundation Center for Effective Schools. And we appreciate those phone calls to Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to, I guess, continue that conversation, probably do it on Facebook. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us. You're listening to WHYY FM Philadelphia and WHYY.org, member supported public media. And come